This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. We're revisiting our series of interviews on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards for some holiday gift-giving ideas. Today, we'll talk to the authors in the children's category. We'll begin with Troy Cummings, the Greencastle native who wrote Can I Be Your Dog? Troy Cummings, welcome to All In.
Hi, good morning, Matt.
So you not only wrote Can I Be Your Dog, you also illustrated this picture book. Can you tell us about the story in this book?
Sure. It's a picture book about a dog named Arfie. He's a little homeless, shaggy mutt, and he lives in this little alley in this small town. And he writes letters to every house in the neighborhood asking if he can be their dog. And one by one, the different houses and businesses write back to him, and they say no for different reasons. But he does find a home at the end of the book.
Yeah, you wrote it entirely through letters. Why'd you make that choice?
You know, it was kind of a challenge from a writing friend of mine to write a book only in letters, and it ended up being this exercise in voice, because we have Arfie's voice as he writes the letters, and then each new character writing back, I'm trying to give them a different voice. So the way they sound, the words they choose, even like their handwriting or the kind of paper they write on, turns it into this kind of back and forth dialogue, and it kind of makes it for a fun read aloud too when you read it to younger kids.
What was Arfie's voice?
Well, I can read a letter from his thing. His very first letter.
Please
says,
do, if you've got a handy.
Sure. Dear people at Yellow House, woof, can I be your dog? You know, he sort of talks like a dog. He leaves out articles sometimes. His writing is really sloppy. I use this big old soft bowling pencil I've had for a long time, as though he were writing, you know, holding this pencil in his snout and pressing really hard. It's all capital letters and really sloppy. And then he signs each letter with a big muddy paw print next to his name.
So you mentioned part of the inspiration came from the letters idea, which a friend of yours had sort of recommended that you give that a try. But was there other inspiration for this book? How did brainstorming work? Why did you want to write this one in particular?
Yeah, so I kind of thought, I want to do a book that's epistolary, that's letters back and forth, and then who should be writing the letter? So I knew I also wanted to do an animal book, and I thought, it's got to be a dog. And I kind of based it off of my old dog. I grew up in Clinton Falls, Indiana, and this dog kind of showed up in our yard one day and we took him in. So I imagined this dog that we took in being, you know, in a little town and writing letters to look for a home. So once I had the dog, the sad dog who needs a home, I kind of made everything fall into place. I could have different people writing back to say no and why they would say no. And it became almost a puzzle to get all of these different people to have different voices and the reasons why they say no. And hopefully we want it to be sadder and sadder and sadder until the end of the book. We want to be surprised when this dog finds a home. So that kind of became the puzzle I was trying to put together as I wrote the book.
Michelle Obama read Can I Be Your Dog during one of her PBS Kids read-alongs. What was that like to have a former first lady read your book?
Oh, that was incredible. I should probably retire right now because that's the highlight of my career, right? It was awesome to have my, you know, the little jokes I write and even my dog language to have him talk in this really funny voice, to have her read my book and do these funny voices and then show my illustrations. It was incredible. I mean, it was absolutely the highlight of my career.
Can you talk about how the book's been received elsewhere and how you've seen it being used?
Sure. Yeah. It is my first book or only book to be a New York Times bestseller. So it kind of hit that list. And I would get all of these messages from parents at homes and then at schools and librarians and teachers using it at schools. What I love about picture books is that you have different kind of ways you're reading this book to a kid. You could read a picture book to a baby in your lap at bedtime, and to an older kid, you'll read this book or use it for story time and do a read aloud and do these funny voices. And then at schools, they'll use picture books. And especially this book, they use for writing assignments, for creative letter writing or persuasive letter writing. So I've seen teachers assign kids to write, can I be your lion or can I be your giraffe? And they'll use mine as the model and then write funny letters from a giraffe giving persuasive arguments as to why a giraffe would be a good pet. So it's kind of popped up in all these ways. Oh, and my favorite thing is since this book has come out, I've gone to book festivals and bookstore events and I'll have signings and I'll be signing books and look up and see people waiting in line, but people will bring their dogs. So it's really, really fun to have someone bring their dog, and I'll autograph a book to someone's dog. And that kind of makes me want to do more dog books.
Has growing up and living in Indiana had some kind of impact on your work, would you say?
Yeah, I think so. So I grew up and kind of lived most of my life here in Putnam County. And as a kid, all through grade school, we lived way out in the woods, and I had a really long bus ride to school. So on that bus ride was this built-in chunk of time every day when I would read and write and draw. And even way early on, I remember I had these little Charlie Brown, like Peanuts comics collections. And I would read these Snoopy comics and start kind of copying them and making my own comics on the bus ride and showing my friends and working with a friend. So on that bus ride is kind of really where I got my start, I think.
So are we going to see, I mean, this is your first New York Times bestseller. That's a big deal. Are we going to see more of Arfi in the future?
Yeah, I actually have a follow-up book called I Found a Kitty that came out this past March. And Arfi finds a tiny kitten in a ditch, and he writes letters again to try to find a home for this kitten. And I am just now, like today, working on a third Arfi book. And I don't even know exactly what it's going to be about, but I want to play with voice some more. And currently it's Arfi writing with other animals. It may be something with classroom pets or something, but I want to have these different animals writing letters back and forth with Arfi, and we'll see where that goes.
Troy Cummings is one of the nominees for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award. In the children's category, his book, Can I Be Your Dog, can be found on the 2020 shortlist. Troy, thanks for joining us today.
Great. Thanks, Matt. Good to be here.
Now we turn to a collection of poems about trains. Skyla Brown is the author of the children's book, Clackety Track. Skyla Brown, welcome.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Matt.
So Clackety Track is a picture book, and it's a collection of poems as well about trains. Why trains?
Well, my first job was on a train. When I was 13, I started working for the Big South Fork Scenic Railway, which is still in operation in Stearns, Kentucky. It's a scenic train that goes into an old coal town that's been recreated by the National Park Service with outdoor structures, kind of like an outdoor museum. So I did that for 5 summers. So I spent a lot of time on the back of a caboose listening to the sound of a train going over the tracks, which I find to be a very soothing sound. So trains are special to me, and I've always enjoyed them. I also think, though, readers, especially young children, it seems like all young kids go through a train phase. So it's a popular choice for picture books.
I have 2 young children. I have a 1-year-old and a 3-year-old, and our house is full of trains.
Yeah.
I can count on at least 2 hands the number of trains or train-related items that we have. So, yes, yeah. you hit the nail on the head. So trains are dynamic and they're sensory when we think about, you know, the noises and the movement and the pace. As you say, it's kind of soothing. Was that something that you tried to capture in the actual poetry?
Absolutely. And I think it's easy fodder for poetry because the sound is so pleasing. I think it's the 3rd or 4th poem in the book is just called Tracks. And the rhythm of it is deliberately synchronized to the way, you know, a train sounds over the tracks. It's very, just the beginning of it is like stretched web path, no start, no end, crisscross the ground. It's very butta, 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 butta,
that yeah.
sound that we're used to hearing. It was easy to play with that in many different poems.
It's a picture book as well. Can you tell us about the illustrations we'll find in there?
The illustrations are gorgeous. They're done by Jamie Kristoff, who's from Ohio, and they're very vintage, retro, kind of throwback. He's great, I think, especially with people. He also is a pet owner. He has a few dogs in his house, and he has incorporated them into some of the illustrations. So when I go into a school and I do a school visit, students really love hearing that, oh, that's his dog. And they like to look for that on the pages as well.
I understand you had the opportunity to work a little bit outside of the box with your illustrator on one of the pictures. What happened there?
I did. So most people don't realize, but 99% of the time when you're collaborating on a picture book, you have an author and an illustrator. And the author writes the words all by himself or herself in isolation and sends it off to the publishing house. And then they meet and they try to find an illustrator who's a good match for that text. And then usually that's it. You don't interact with each other at all. The illustrator does his or her part. And then together it all gets put together. And you might weigh in with a few comments here and there. But there really isn't much of a collaboration. With this book, I deliberately saved a space in the book. I saved a poem and said, I want the illustrator to choose a spread. So let's check with him and see what he wants to do. And he wanted to do something really that makes use of his vintage talents. I think he chose the Whistle Stop Tour page. So he did the illustration and I made the words to match with that. So we kind of did it backwards on that one, which was a lot of fun.
I think that sounds fantastic. And okay, now you gave us a little bit of a sample a little bit ago of one of the poems. Do you have another one handy? I kind of just want the rhythm.
Sure. How about we try the very end, the last poem in the book, which is called Sleeper Train.
Okay.
It says, hush, here comes a train. Open the walls and pull the beds down. Climb up and slide in and don't move around. Hook on the sleep straps and slip right through town. Hush, here comes a train. Hush, here comes a train. Chuggity, huffledy, snuggle down deep. Clackety, trackety, counting of sheep. Clinkety, rockety, sleepity, sleep. Hush, here comes a train.
Why did you want to close out with that one?
It's nice, I think, to end with a bedtime poem. A lot of us who are parents are reading these books before bed. And I know from my days when I was reading to my children when they were younger, it was always nice to have, especially if you're reading a book that maybe has some exciting and kind of revved up pages, it's nice to end with one that's a little calmer. The rhythm of the poem is calmer. The illustration, which it's a shame this is radio and you can't see, but it's very blue and it's very calm. It makes you sleepy just looking at it. So I think it's a good one to end. The first poem in the book is Morning Time in the Yard. So everyone's waking up. So it's a natural end to the book to end with everyone going to sleep.
What did you most enjoy about writing it?
Probably the sound and playing with, you know, as a poet, it's really nice to have some great opportunities in your toolbox there to play with it for rhythm and sound. For this particular book, I oftentimes when I'm writing, I'll have specific background sounds happening. Sometimes it's music, but sometimes it's just, you know, you can go on the internet and get like the sound of a crackling fire or something like that. So obviously while I was drafting this, I heard a lot of different train sounds, which I personally find a comforting sound. So I enjoyed listening to that while I was writing.
Skyla Brown is the author of Clackety Track, Poems About Trains. Skyla, it's great to talk with you.
Thanks for having me, Matt. It was a pleasure.
Up next, a true story about an Indiana basketball team that defied the odds and changed history. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 90 seconds, this is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards, and we're looking at the books in the children's category for some holiday gift-giving ideas. And now, my conversation with this year's winner, Philip Hose. Philip Hose, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Matt.
So, Hoosiers out there that are big basketball fans are likely familiar with the story of the Crispus Attucks Tigers and their 1955 state championship win, but for those who are unfamiliar, what's the story there?
Well, the story is that in 1927, Crispus Attucks High School was built with taxpayer money to quarantine black students and teachers to keep them apart from the white population. One of the first things the school tried to do was gain membership to the Indiana High School Athletic Association so they could play in the state tournament. And they were rejected and rejected and rejected. They tried year after year after year, and they could not get in until really World War II. And they finally began to build a program made up of boys that had come up from the South on buses with their parents as part of the first great migration of blacks north. They didn't know how to play basketball. They had been, you know, used to doing farm work, but they got a great coach in Ray Crow and began to learn the game. And really the community got together behind them. They went all the way to the Final Four in 1951. And then the Robertson family moved to Indianapolis from Tennessee. That's Oscar Robertson, one of the great players that ever lived.
Sure.
And it all came together in 1955. They won the state championship, beating out 700 and some other schools, and gained the respect that they had so sought as African-Americans to by winning the state tournament.
Why was it important to you to tell this story?
Well, I grew up in Indiana, and it was always weird to me that there was a school that all blacks had to go to. I went to Speedway High School, and it was just 6 miles down 16th Street from Crispus Attucks High School. And yet those 6 miles might have been universes, you know, and I wondered a lot about it. Later, after I had moved away from Indiana, I got a magazine assignment from Sports Illustrated to do some interviewing about why Indiana was such a crazy basketball state, why it seemed to mean so much there. And in the course of all that, I met Oscar Robertson, who was a hero of mine, and got to talk with him for a while. And at one point he said, you know, people in Indianapolis were crazy. It was crazy when the Klan built our school. And I said, what do you mean the Klan built your school? And he said, yeah, that's true. The Ku Klux Klan put up the money to build the school. And I said, well, tell me all you know about it. He didn't know much. And he said, you're the writer, you do the research. And so and so I did. I did the research, and I found that not only in the 1920s was one of every three white males in Indiana a member of the Ku Klux Klan, but it affected so many families, including my own. I found out that my grandfather was a Klansman, that my Aunt Anne's first memory was going to a cross burning, that my Aunt Ellen, my dear Aunt Ellen, who saved pennies in a jar for me, had a property, and in the deed to the property, it said that it could never be sold to a black, a Catholic, or a Jew. I mean, this was everywhere. It infected everything in Indiana there for a while. And so I just wanted to write about it.
How was the city changed by the Crispus Attucks team?
One way that it was changed was blacks started going to other high schools. The athletic directors to the schools in Indianapolis, the athletic directors of Shortridge and Manual and Tech, started fearing that by putting all blacks, who they presumed to be physically superior, by putting them all in one high school, they had inadvertently really messed up. They had made it so that all the talent in the city was going to one school, and they had to break it up. So after Attucks won in 1955 and 1956, the doors started opening to other schools. So that was a big change, that black kids could now go to Tech and could go to Shortridge and places like that. Another thing that was really great about it was it showed what kids could do. So much of the racial history of the United States, and that meant Indiana, you know, as well, happened because kids made a difference, reached out, made a difference. Those kids, Oscar Robertson, when they won the state championship in 1955 for the first time, he was only 16 years old. And if you look hard at history, at U.S. history, young people made enormous contributions, some of which are documented and some of which are not. And I wanted to document this one. I wanted people to know that, first of all the racial tension and Jim Crowness in the United States wasn't just in Mississippi and Georgia. It was in border states and northern states as well, like Indiana. And I wanted people to know that young people made an enormous contribution in Indiana. Indiana was really the only place where a story like that could have happened, because basketball, high school basketball, meant more in Indiana than it did anywhere else in the United States. So they found a particularly basketballish way to cause social change.
Has this book been used in educational settings?
In Indiana, it has, not so much elsewhere.
And in what ways? Do you know where? Or have you been able to talk to any of the classrooms using it?
Yeah, I've done some touring with the book, and mainly in Eastern and Midwestern states and cities. It's not a very well-known story. It is in Indiana, but it's not elsewhere. And people's eyes widen. You know, they can't believe that this had happened. Most people don't know, even despite the movie Hoosiers, how big a deal basketball was and still is really in Indiana. 13 of the 14 biggest high school gyms in the United States are still in Indiana. And communities emptied their checkbooks and pocketbooks to build big gyms that were bigger than the gym down the road so they could host the sectional tournament. It was just nuts, you know, in Indiana.
What do you hope readers take away from this?
I hope that they take away that Jim Crow was not just a Southern bird, that it was also a Hoosier bird. And I hope that they can admire the resilience and toughness of the Crispus Attucks community. Basically, they spent 25 years trying to win one basketball game, the state championship, and they did it. They cracked the door for the ability to even play in the tournament because they were rebuffed for so long. But I want them to know that Indiana was a tough place to be African-American, that kids made an enormous difference, that Indiana was a state where racial progress was made, albeit by an unusual way, through basketball.
Philip Hose is the author of Attucks, Oscar Robertson and the Basketball Team That Awakened a City. It's one of the nominees for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the children's category. Phil, great to talk with you today.
Great to talk with you, Matt. Thanks a lot.
The protagonist of this next book might remind you of a few other spunky and curious characters in children's literature, and part of that is very much by design. Get ready to meet the magnificent Maya Tibbs. Crystal Allen, welcome to All In.
Thank you so very much, Matt. I'm so excited to be here.
Oh, I'm excited to have you. So the magnificent Maya Tibbs, can you introduce us to Maya and how she came to be?
Well, I sure can. It's kind of crazy a little. My editor asked me to create an African-American Ramona Quimby, and I had absolutely no idea how to do that. I mean, for those people who have read Ramona, she is one of a kind. So how do you try to mimic that? I had no idea, Matt, but I told him I'd try. So I did. I tried and I failed. To myself, I did. I hadn't handed anything in yet, but I continued to try. And then one day I was sitting at the computer thinking about how am I going to create this African-American Ramona Quimby. And all of a sudden in my mind, these pink cowgirl boots started appearing in my head. And I'm thinking, what is this? And the more her body came in, I saw this brown vest and this cowgirl hat. And I'm like, oh, no, Lord, please don't let this little girl be a cowgirl, because I don't like country or Western, Matt. And I'm thinking, how am I going to create a character that I don't even like? But it turned out amazing. Maya and I became incredible friends. And the more I created a story for her, the more I fell in love with her. She was so independent. She, this 9-year-old girl who loved family, loved friends, she just became so easy to write about.
And so the book that's on the short list this year is Maya in the Middle, and it's part of a greater series about Maya. What's she up to in this book?
Well, and with Maya in the Middle, it continues with books 1 and 2, except Maya's mom was going to have a baby, and the baby is born in book three. And Maya has an older brother, and now she's the middle child, and she doesn't know where her place is. Her parents aren't able to really give her the attention that they had before because they've got this newborn and they're tired all the time. And her older brother is so smart that's just not something that she believes that she could keep up with. So she doesn't know her place. She's stuck in the middle and she's just trying to find her way.
What do you want young readers to learn from Maya? What messages do you try to put in there?
The message that I'm trying to put in there, Matt, is most 9-year-olds love family, love friends, and they're trying to find out who they are. An independence more than anything, to just walk by the beat of your own drum and don't worry about what everyone else is doing, and to just love life and be free with it. Maya is all of those things. And I believe all of those things are positive. So that is the message that I want all of Maya's readers to find, hopefully find when they read her.
You know, Ramona Quimby she's a funny character. Maya sounds like a funny character. In what ways is she unique in a funny sort of way?
Well, Maya has an older brother, and she nicknamed him Nugget. And she calls him Nugget because his skin is brown and his head is shaped like a chunk of chicken. That's how she sees him. He thinks that she nicknamed him Nugget after a piece of gold. Maya also just has a way of saying things, like when she's upset, she might say good gravy in the Navy. She just has all kinds of little things about her that makes her unique and also funny at the same time. So I think that children, especially those who don't like to read or haven't found a book that resonates with them, humor sometimes will do that. And I'm hoping that Maya is able to capture some of those readers so that they can enjoy a book.
Did you have any favorite children's books growing up?
I had one that's still my absolute favorite, and that is Charlotte's Web. I grew up in New Albany, Indiana, which is really close to Louisville, Kentucky, just a little small town, but I lived on a farm and I didn't have any neighbors. So, no other kids to play with. All I had were the animals on the farm. And it was kind of lonely sometimes. And when I went to school, we didn't have a library. We had a bookmobile that came through. And the librarian on that bookmobile, I guess she found out somehow or another, because I was a new kid. She found out that I lived on a farm and gave me a Charlotte's Web. And it really, Matt, it wasn't Wilbur and it wasn't Charlotte that I fell in love with in that story. It was actually Fern.
Ah.
She was just like me, you know? She lived on a farm. She had a brother. I had two. She loved animals. I loved animals. I would have saved Wilbur. And I didn't have that many friends. So I was able to connect with her. And believe it or not, I know this kind of sounds crazy and I don't need medication. Let me just preface that. But Fern still visits me sometimes when I'm writing. And it's almost like her and Wilbur are looking over my shoulder, just like a friend. And that's kind of how I wanted to make Maya for somebody, a friend that visits them every once in a while, like Fern visits me.
I guess that leads to this. Is there any part of your Indiana experience that makes its way into your writing, whether it's specifically Indiana or just what kind of what you grew up around?
Yes. Indiana has played a massive part in my writing. My very first book that I wrote, How Lamar's Bad Prank Won a Bubba-Sized Trophy, that story actually takes place in Indiana. But all of my writing, Matt, I think came about because of my childhood. When I was younger, I thought this was horrible that I didn't have anybody to play with after school or before school or on the weekends because I didn't live near anyone. So I ended up having to make friends with the animals, the horses, and all of the stray dogs that ended up on our farm. The pigs, I would run with them. And I had no idea how that would play a part in my creativity when I became a writer. It was, or it is, huge how I'm able to think outside of the box. And I completely thank my Indiana roots for that.
Crystal Allen is the author of the magnificent Maya Tibbs series. Crystal, what a joy. It was great talking to you.
It was great talking to you too, Matt. And thank you so very much.
When we come back, we have a book for science and animal lovers out there. Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards with a look at the nominees in the children's book category, in case you have some young readers on your holiday gift-giving list. I'm Matt Pelser, back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Today, we're revisiting our series on the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Awards for some holiday gift-giving ideas. We're talking with the children's book authors nominated this year, and right now we're talking with Gabriel Balkin, the author of The Book of Flight, 10 Record-Breaking Animals with Wings. Gabriel Balkin, welcome.
Thank you so much. Hi, Matt.
So what are we exploring in The Book of Flight?
Well, we're exploring flight across animals, and we're exploring how animal flight kind of connects to human interest in flight and what humans learn from animal flight and then adapt for our own interests and activities. And my favorite thing about this book was researching it and learning that animals fly in different ways, which is not something I ever knew before or even thought that much about.
So were you familiar with a lot of these critters before you wrote the book, or was some of this also new to you?
It was completely new to me. And that's usually how I choose my topics of what I'm going to research and then write about, because I have some kind of question of my own. And people in my family, my stepdad loves dragonflies and is always pointing them out. And as a child, I think I tuned out a little bit. But once my own kids started having an interest in it, I was like, I need to talk to him and find out more about this. And it's one of those things where once you start thinking about it, you see examples of how differently these animals fly all over the place. And dragonflies, one of my favorite things about them is you may have seen how their wings are completely clear, but on the end of each wing is one cell that's a darker color, and that cell is weighted, and it helps the dragonfly stabilize themselves as they zoom and dive bomb people or other animals and kind of protect their territory.
Fascinating. I love dragonflies too. And I mean, there are a few fun facts about dragonflies that you can kind of throw out there at people or at kids. Of course, kids latch onto that sort of thing. What did you share? What else did you share in the book about dragonflies?
Oh, let's see. Well, I didn't know. So the difference between a dragonfly and a damselfly is that dragonflies, their wings, even at rest, always stay directly out next to them, where other animals that fly, like a butterfly, they'll fold their wings when they're at rest. And, you know, in addition to that, there's so many different types of dragonflies. There's a million, not a million, I'm exaggerating, but there's a lot of different species. And I think before I started researching this book, I kind of thought a dragonfly is a dragonfly. How can there be that many different kinds?
The book is filled with facts, obviously, but there's some deeper themes at play as well. What are some of the bigger ideas we'll find in the book?
one of the things I hope that readers get a sense of is that there's lots of different ways to measure things in our world. So a lot of children know who they think the fastest bird is that flies, and they almost all say the peregrine falcon. And that's true that that's the fastest bird when it comes to diving. But there's also a way to measure the fastest bird when it comes to soaring straight ahead, or the fastest bird while they're flapping their wings. And so there's lots of different ways to examine the world around us, and different questions can have more than one answer depending on how you look at it. So that's one idea I think is really interesting to think about.
Kids could take that in a lot of different ways, but the way I'm taking it is, yeah, someone can be the best at this, but you can be the best at something else that's like that.
Exactly, exactly. And so you can kind of celebrate your own accomplishments and attach a record breaker to it. The example I always give is, if I was to have a foot race against, you know, one of my kids, if we were running on the beach, they would probably run faster than I can. But if I was to race them to the cup of coffee in the morning, I'm going to win every single time.
Oh, you're speaking to me. So had you written other books like this before?
I had. And I had written the first book sort of in this idea was a book of animal bones called The Book of Bones. And my editor and I came up with the idea together because we knew that kids were fascinated with bones and kids were also fascinated with records. And so we wanted to find a way to combine the two things together. And we enjoyed working together so much. And we adored the illustrator also, Sam Brewster, that we wanted to come up with another idea to kind of go along in this same theme. And animals that fly seemed like a great combination with animals and their bones, because one is sort of in the air and like light. So it seemed like a nice combination to go with that.
The way that you balance the narrative and the, you know, the actual facts, the information is really clever in this book. Can you talk about how you chose to format the book?
Sure. You know, we wanted to, I like the idea of these animals being in competition with each other, you know, because kids sometimes like to compete with each other, who's the best at whatever. And so I like the idea of these animals kind of bragging about their own flying abilities, where the vulture has their very unique ways of flying and they want to tell everybody about that. So we set up the book where you open a spread and you see a diagram of the animal. So it almost looks like an architect's or an engineer's spread. And that animal is sort of bragging about their flight. And then the reader has to guess based on a certain clues about how big their feet are, if they have feet. And then you turn the page and you get this beautiful full color spread that shows the animal in its environment. And we don't advertise this fact. We let readers discover it on their own. But if you touch the page where the animal is revealed, their wings are textured. And so you can kind of highlight the neat parts of their wings and even take a piece of paper over it and make like a stencil, a drawing, a rubbing with a pencil or a crayon.
Ah. What age range did you have in mind?
You know, for the first book, Book of Bones, we had a slightly younger audience in mind, kind of that like 5-year-old. And this one, we thought the subject matter could be a little bit more complex. So we said maybe a little bit older. We're writing it towards an 8-year-old. But those like 3-year-olds and 4-year-olds loves facts so much. You can read it with them and they'll really key in on the, you know, the really fun, interesting facts. So we say about 5 to 8, 5 to 9 or so.
Have you heard from readers? What are people thinking?
I heard from, I love hearing from readers because it just buoys me and kind of helps me get back to my, you know, my writing tablet to keep on going. But I heard from a grandparent who said that her granddaughter was writing her about vultures. And the two of them had this really neat vulture relationship. And this little 5-year-old feels very protective around vultures because people tend to think of them as sort of, you know, not beautiful creatures or kind of odd animals. And I thought that was amazing, that it was a great generational connection between these birds.
I love that. Gabriel Balkan is the author of The Book of Flight, 10 Record-Breaking Animals with Wings. Gabriel, thanks so much for speaking with us. It's great to have you.
It was a pleasure.
And finally, if there was only so much magic in the world, only so many wishes that could be granted, how would you decide which wishes come true? That's one of the questions that author John David Anderson explores in his new book, Granted. John David Anderson, welcome to All In.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
Granted takes us to a whole new fantasy fiction world where we meet a particular fairy. Can you tell me about her and her journey?
Yeah, so her name is Ophelia Delphinium Fidgets, and she is a granter, which is a specific role that you can play in the fairy granting community. And her job is to go out into the human world, find whatever object a wish has been made on, and then undergo the magic ritual that makes that wish come true. She's a rookie, so she's never actually been on one of these missions before, and she's really excited and determined to prove her worth to the rest of the fairy community. The problem is, once she gets to the coin that this wish is made on, where she's got to grant this wish, it gets away from her. And that sort of starts her into a series of hazards and obstacles and barriers that she has to overcome as she goes through this journey to try and make this wish happen. And then ultimately, when she finally gets to the coin, she finds out there's two wishes made on the same coin. She only has enough magic to grant one, because, of course, magic is in limited supply, which explains why you and I probably haven't had a lot of our wishes granted. And I know I've blown out lots of birthday candles and, you know, never got that bike. So she gets to the coin, and there's two wishes made on the same coin, and she has to decide which wish she's going to grant, because granting one could mean the end of fairy life as she knows it, but granting the other one would break her heart. And it's ultimately about how we balance those needs, how we decide how to use the limited resources, the limited magic, as it were, to give as much, to bring as much good into the world as we can.
Aha, there's the message. So is fantasy writing something new to you?
It's not, actually. I kind of got my start with that. My very first novel, Standard Hero Behavior, was sort of swords and sorcery fantasy. And then I wrote a couple of superhero books. But I jump back and forth. So I write realistic fiction, and then I'll do speculative fiction. Kind of depends on the mood, kind of depends on what I've been doing, kind of depends on whether or not I need an escape. Because for me, of course, that's one of the great things about fantasy, is it takes you to brand new worlds far away. And then only afterwards, you kind of sit back and realize, oh, wait a minute, you know, this was actually everything that's going on with us today. It was just couched in different terms.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay. And when you're away from it for a while, do you feel like your creativity recharges in a way?
Absolutely. I mean, the great thing about realistic fiction, of course, is that it sort of can touch an instant nerve with my young readers. You know, I write for kids between the ages of 8 and 14, and I still very much feel the way that they feel, you know, all that anxiety. I still feel like I'm growing up. I still feel like I'm trying to figure out the things that I believe in. So I've been 13 for a while now. But the thing about fantasy for me is, yeah, it harnesses those places in your imagination where you can go places that no one else has ever gone before. Or you can take places that people have gone before and twist them up. I mean, I'm obviously not the first person to write about fairies. You know, they've been around for centuries and centuries, going back to mythology and folklore. But to find a way to make that story refreshing and new and give it a modern twist, that really gets the cerebrum working.
At the risk of asking a very generic question, I'm just very curious. What did you read growing up that was fantasy, sort of the classic fantasy?
Yeah. And for me, I would have to say it probably was classic fantasy. You know, obviously, I went to Narnia. I went to Middle Earth.
Sure.
Probably the one that had the most influence on me was Lloyd Alexander and the Chronicles of Prydain. I'm not sure how you pronounce it, you know, but it was a fantasy series. And it was so funny. And I think that's what set it apart. From, you know, C.S. Lewis and Tolkien, was just rife with humor. And I think since then, that's had a big influence on my writing, because no matter how serious something gets or even how fantastical, I try to ground it in my sense of humor. You know? So all of my books are a little bit smart alecky, a little bit sarcastic, a little bit a lot of irony, some parody, some satire. And I think that all stems from my reading as a youth.
I'm so glad to hear that. I mean, because I feel like sometimes fantasy can take itself a little too seriously. And I think that's okay in some ways, but maybe not as approachable in others.
Yeah. And I mean, I think every writer is different. But I find myself when I'm writing a fantasy novel, if I get to that point where I am taking it too seriously, like I laugh at myself. I'll read a sentence which is overly dramatic and, you know, is full of all this jargon that I've created for this world. And I'm like, wait a minute. There's no way that my reader's going to be able to connect with this. So it's a balancing act like everything else.
Do you find that living in Indiana has influenced your writing at all?
I mean, most of my realistic novels are set in the Midwest. I try to avoid setting them directly here in Indianapolis, even though this is the city I've lived in for almost all of my life, just for fear, I guess, of getting something wrong. But they're all set in the Midwest. And so there's something about Midwestern values that probably permeates each of my characters. But I think more than that is just how it's influenced me as a writer, as an author, as a thinker, in that, you know, I really appreciate the peace and quiet that I can get here. I mean, there's plenty to do if you want to do. There's plenty to see if you want to get your imagination engaged. But it's also not hard to just find a little patch, a green somewhere, and sit there with your thoughts and tell your stories. And so I think it's that combination, both of the sort of value system that I incorporate in my books, and also the fact that this is a great space, I think, to be a writer.
The value of libraries is something that means a lot to you. Can you talk about what libraries mean to you, and has that changed at all since becoming a writer?
It's changed. I don't think it's decreased any. I think it's just changed valences depending on where I'm at in my stage in life. You know, for as a kid, like I said, it was kind of an escape. A way to open all these great new doors and go to all these great new worlds that I never experienced before. And then I became a father, and then it was something else entirely. You know, it was a chance to teach and to share the things that I loved, and to pull my kids into all these worlds. And then as an author, obviously, you know, not only is it a huge boon to me in terms of getting my word out and getting my works out into the hands of the kids who need them, but also because, you know, I really feel part of this great big literary enterprise and this community. And I think that creating a literate culture is really, it's the key to everything. You know, it's the key to making democracy work. It's the key to bringing about social change. It's the key to keeping us all sane, I think, and keeping things balanced. And so I believe that not only do libraries serve just that hugely central function in creating, growing a kid's brain, right, making their imagination soar, but it just has undeniable value in terms of creating communities and giving people a chance to, like, interact socially and try to make some positive changes.
John David Anderson is the author of Granted, one of the books nominated for the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award in the children's category. Dave, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Matt.
We got to a lot of the titles on the shortlist today, but if you're looking for more titles to check out, Michael Homoya's Wake Up Woods and Helen Frost's Hello, I'm Here are also nominated books this year, worth gifting. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron's our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme. If you like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it wherever you get podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.